In just over a decade, Katy Perry's career has turned from a teenage dream into a full-fledged waking nightmare. Her fall from the upper echelons of pop music has been one for the ages, and it's also kind of been, depressingly, a death by a thousand cuts. There have been a few major disasters we could point to answer the question of how Katy Perry murdered her career, but its inevitable demise was kind of like a gradual poisoning. Pop stardom is a game of agility. It's about learning how to contort yourself, the artist and product, into the confines of the prevailing moment. It's pretty rare for a pop star to fall out of a coconut tree and hit big. It's a call and response kind of a gig. You put feelers out, you measure the response, and you adjust or continue accordingly. After all, you're here to sell a product. Making pop music that isn't popular winds up being kind of embarrassing. This is the part of pop stardom that Katy Perry has failed spectacularly at. She does not know when to change course. I mean, she's a Scorpio, but of course, she's stubborn. When she commits to a bit, she really doubles down, and that serves her when she's on a winning streak, but she's kind of unable to see the forest for the trees while her grip loosens on the moment. Having your grip on the moment and understanding how to shapeshift into what that moment is the key to continued relevance as a pop star. Taylor Swift has spoken before about how exhausting it is to have to transform yourself every era or album cycle. But be that as it may, it has not stopped her from trafficking in the kind of shocking, jarring twists and turns that keep a fickle public interested. Katy Perry has done this too, cutting her hair, switching up her album packaging, but there is something distinctly hollow about her music. There is rarely a story to tell behind the pomp and circumstance of her many rebrands, especially with this latest record, 143, which has bridged the gap from bad into embarrassing, a flop in the truest sense of the word. To have such institutional backing behind you and for your record to fail at this level is really quite impressive. And of course, this album rollout was handled disastrously, from the heinous woman's world to the forgettable lifetimes and the insipid I'm his, he's mine. There is no story being told on these songs and no connective tissue between them. In a certain sense, 143 is like a parody of a pop album. It has all the makings of a big pop moment, legacy artist, budget for the gods, VMA performances, glossy visuals, and yet it has failed to even make a dent in pop culture beyond being made fun of for flopping. Why? Because it's a product. We can tell that Katy Perry is trying to sell us something, but we don't know what it is that we're buying or why we even should in the first place. We can see there's a machine behind her conspiring to get us to want to buy it, and yet it fails to connect. The more she hard sells, the worse the songs do. I'm His, He's Mine, even after a VMA debut, was her first single that failed to debut on any Spotify chart in any country. There is something deeply cynical and robotic about the Katy Perry that we're seeing on 143. This is a meaningless collection of products designed to hopefully make their way into algorithmically programmed playlists and burrow into your brain somehow. Let's be clear, 143 is not an artistic statement. It is not a comeback. It is not a rebrand. It is not a rebirth. It just is. I've always said that it's worse to be boring than bad, and somehow, 143 has managed to be both of those things. It feels even more cynical with the baffling, humiliating, and honestly, shameful inclusion of Dr. Luke, who, even as the literal architect of her former glory teenage dream, cannot coax the fun Katy Perry out of this caricature. To be honest, a colossal flop of this magnitude was long overdue for Katy, who has struggled to find her footing as a pop star since her third album, Prism's release in 2013. When I see the Katy Perry of 2024 hanging off the side of a helicopter after performing a nonsensical TikTok dance, holding a ring light shaped like the female sex symbol, screaming her name to the world because she knows the pop audience of today may not even be familiar with her anymore. That's how long it's been since she's had a hit. I feel sad and confused, and I want to look away. But today, we are not looking away. I want to try and make sense of how, in a little more than a decade, you can go from being the biggest pop star in the world to a forgettable 2010s dance pop act that people like to get down to at weddings while asking, hey, whatever happened to her? This is How to Murder Your Career, a one-woman show starring Katy Perry. This video was intended to just be about 143 flopping, but as I was getting into the script writing, I think the seed of this floppage starts from the very earliest point of her career. So this is basically, from start to finish, a career autopsy. Welcome to my channel, or welcome back to my channel. My name is Zach. I am the Swiftologist, and I make thoughtful weekly videos about pop culture. If you like these thorough deep dives into pop culture history, then you are definitely going to find something that you like on this channel. I talk about Taylor Swift a lot, but I talk about a lot of other things too. So I hope that you'll consider giving this video a thumbs up and subscribing to my channel. Now, I need to make an address to the Katy Cats of the world. I like Katy Perry. In fact, when I was like, 15 years old, I waited 12 hours in the hot sun to get front row for her show in Singapore. I am a Katy Cat, or I was a Katy Cat at some point in time. I really enjoy some aspects of Katy Perry's music, and I think that she is an important figure in pop culture. The reason why I make this video to point out where it went wrong is because I like it when people are their very best and when they try hard and swing big and, you know, take risks and achieve new heights of excellence. And Katy Perry just has consistently failed to do that. And I think that if you're going to put your music out there, put yourself out there like this, shove yourself down people's throats, then it is completely fair game for people to respond. I'm a critic. My job is literally to critique pop music. I got accused on TikTok of trying to start a Katy Perry hate train and that I was being paid to do this. The only person paying me to do this is myself, basically, because I'm the one that's in control of my destiny and my finances. But Katy Perry does not need someone to start a hate train for her. She did that all by herself. She literally created this entire scenario that I'm gonna walk you through today. So I suggest if you're having an issue with what's being said in this video and you really want to let it out in the comment section, first of all, you're gonna get blocked. I'm not engaging with the nonsense, so don't try me. I love thoughtful discussions in my comment section, but if you become nasty, which you so often do, then I will just block you. And, you know, if you really are wanting to prove that Katy Perry is a legend and the queen, she's never done anything wrong in her life, this album is great, I suggest that you go and stream the album and buy it, because you're not doing a very good job of that. You might be camping in my comment section, but you're not actually helping Katy Perry succeed. So who doesn't care about Katy Perry's legacy here? Because I spent hours constructing this thoughtful commentary on why Katy Perry, I think, is failing to connect. And you are spending hours inventing conspiracy theories in my comment section. Go outside, beloved. We literally have to go through the Katy Perry origin story to arrive at the conclusion that I've come to. So let's just get straight into it. Katherine Hudson grew up in a strict religious, sheltered environment, raised by two pastors with rather conservative beliefs. These conservative beliefs prohibited Katy from listening to any kind of secular music whatsoever while she was growing up. And keep in mind that as an artist, gospel music was her most formative musical influence as a child. This is the spiritual seed of her identity crisis, I think. She had no real shaping as an artist. When we hear artists speak of those who inspired them, it's usually from a very young age. You can hear that influence in their music, especially in their early attempts, because a lot of like creativity is copying other people and seeing how that works for you. Katy Perry was kind of culturally unmoored, doomed to mimic and copy and just try on different personas with one hope: fame by any means necessary. Something that I really admire about Katy is her resilience, but also her drive and her ambition. Success was really not an overnight thing for her. She always wanted to sing and make music, taking lessons from a very young age, and her first record was a Christian effort titled Katy Hudson, which sold only 200 copies before her label went bankrupt. After this setback with gospel music, she transitioned to secular music. After that didn't work, we have the first rebrand. When she first arrived in LA, she was told that Katy Hudson was kind of a doomed name for her, causing confusion in comparison with the actress who was already very successful, Kate Hudson. So what does she do instead? She adopts her mother's maiden name, Perry, and becomes Katy Perry. She links up with Glenn Ballard, a producer and writer, at age 17 to write some songs together. She chooses him because he worked on an album that she had happened to listen to and really liked, Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill, which was one of the first non-Christian records she had ever encountered. In a 2013 interview with Entertainment Weekly, she said that Jagged Little Pill really helped her feel understood, and it made her want to be Alanis Morissette. And I think that we can see that very clearly in her debut record, One of the Boys, but even more blatantly in the demo work that preceded it. So she's writing all of these songs and doing small performances, workshopping this kind of like angsty singer-songwriter ballady stuff. An early demo by Katy and Glenn Ballard is a song called Simple, which was made famous by its moody music video and inclusion in her iconic documentary, Part of Me. It is very, shall we say, edgy. It's very Alanis Morissette light. It's very Avril Lavigne copy, with gorgeous lyrics such as, I wipe my hands on your jeans because they are more distressed. Melodically, the song is not very interesting at all. She's almost slurring her words in this very affected performance. It's quite the stark difference from the Katy Perry that we know now. The one really authentic part of her personality that I think is a through line through her career, though, for sure, is a certain characteristic brightness, an optimism, a cheekiness, a level of kitsch and earnestness. This is really not at all evident in this demo or any of the kinds of songs that she was writing at this time. So why write them? Well, I suspect that she saw what was doing well in the music industry at large and wanted to emulate it in hopes of her own success. We're in the wake of Kelly Clarkson's massive breakaway era. We have Avril Lavigne topping the charts again in 2007 with The Rockish Girlfriend. Fall Out Boy is having a huge pop-punk moment, and Linkin Park manages to have a kind of crossover rock-pop hit with What I've Done. Glenn Ballard signs her to his label Java Records, which was an imprint or affiliated with Def Jam, but the album she planned to release was shelved. So let's talk about that album. After Ballard's label folded, Katie was introduced to Tim Devine, who is an A&R rep at Columbia Records, who signed her as a solo artist. She had compiled her debut album, which was roughly titled Fingertips, some of which made it actually onto One of the Boys, and she hoped to release it in 2007. Some of these songs ended up going elsewhere later on, notably to Kelly Clarkson, which is ironic for her fourth record, All I Ever Wanted. But this is kind of an accidental development deal between her and Columbia, because her work never ended up getting released formally. But she got a lot of experience working with other writers who were complete legends of their time. Butch Walker, noted collaborator of Avril Lavigne, Cara Diaguardi, who worked with all of your Y2K girly faves, Max Martin, The Matrix, and Dr. Luke. And this was all before she really got signed, but she wasn't a priority for a lot of these writers. She was really kind of in on the ground floor of the Dr. Luke thing, to give some credit to her and their relationship that has continued to this very day. They came up together for sure. The next part of this story is where she gets dropped and signed again. And this is very well documented in the, again, iconic 2012 documentary film, Part of Me. But basically, after Katie was dropped in 2007, a publicity executive at Columbia who really believed in Katie saw the potential in her and gave her demos to Capitol Records, who eventually saw the vision, largely due to a little B-side called Waking Up in Vegas. Yes, what would go on to be the fourth single from One of the Boys. This song piqued the label's interest especially. Some of the executives from Capitol went to go see a Katie showcase that she had put on at the Viper Room in LA, and they said that it was pretty bad. It was pretty underwhelming, but they saw the potential and decided to take a chance on her. But it was all dependent on one thing, the right record. So what did they do? They instantly hooked her back up with the producer du jour, Dr. Luke, and actually gave a budget so that he had to, you know, devote some energy and time to her. And this was a smart decision given the Alanis Morissette inclinations that Katie had at the time. Dr. Luke had very famously worked on Kelly Clarkson, Since You've Been Gone, as well as Behind These Hazel Eyes, taking the Alanis Morissette influence and making it more mainstream pop. And these were experiences that Kelly Clarkson hated, by the way. She was literally forced to work with him, but more on that later. Dr. Luke at this point was really on a winning streak, having just produced much of Avril Lavigne's hugely successful record, The Best Damn Thing, some of Pink's iconic comeback record, I'm Not Dead, and what he was able to apply to Katie's tepid angst and songwriting was polish and impact. When you compare the production and vocal delivery of Simple, that demo, and I Kissed a Girl, her debut single, the difference is stark. Milquetoast brooding singer-songwriter Katy Perry was never going to make it. The songs simply were not good enough, and her delivery was not convincing. What she did have was a kind of willingness or desperation to do whatever it took to break through after 5 years of broken promises and failed attempts. Let's talk about what Katie's winning characteristic is. It's her sense of humor. She's at her best when she is being a little bit irreverent. Things go tits up when she starts to talk about the state of the universe or being a witness. But her sense of humor kind of carries her middling average musical talents to something fun, kitschy, and enjoyable. A guilty pleasure in the truest sense of the phrase. Dr. Luke and Katie came up with I Kissed a Girl, You're So Gay, Hot and Cold, and Mannequin in their writing session. And the rest of One of the Boys was comprised from the best of the demos that made up Katy Perry's unreleased album, Fingertips. So it was kind of a Frankenstein effort in that sense. It carries a lot of baggage with it for being a debut album, and a lot of the songs on it are actually very old. So the first attempt to introduce Katie to the mass market was You're So Gay, and I think that this was an excellent choice. It's definitely the bridge between Simple and I Kissed a Girl. This is a great, funny song that probably wouldn't get released in 2024. I hope you hang yourself with your H&M scarf while jacking off listening to Mozart. It was just funny and ironic enough to impress the Pitchfork crowd, but not too far left to alienate pop radio entirely. And it wasn't exactly an overnight success. Here's what Chris, whose last name I can't pronounce, Katie's A&R rep, had to say about its release. We put out You're So Gay as a single as a kind of introduction because we thought that we'd have to build her story all over again. It was kind of a novelty song. We never had plans to go to radio. We just wanted to put it out online and see what the attraction was. We shot a low-budget music video and the response was great. We didn't expect to sell 50,000 EPs and we sure didn't. We only sold a few thousand. In my opinion, it did well in terms of building a press story, but because people didn't run to iTunes to buy the EP, some executives in the company started backpedaling. It was not, in fact, a straight shot from You're So Gay to Katie's actual debut single, I Kissed a Girl. In fact, a lot of her breakthrough was actually out of her hands. The executives were really not sold on Katie for a very long time until the right record came along, and it didn't help that she had been dropped twice before landing at Capitol. In fact, and I think that this is a really essential part of the Katy Perry lore, which also helps to explain why she's been slow to connect after her peak, is that her success was really architected for her by other people. And if not by other people, in heavy collaboration with other people. Here's Chris, her original A&R rep again, on the breakthrough moment. A lot of people think it happened overnight for Katy Perry, but it didn't. She was signed multiple times, and it took us 14 to 18 months to actually get her out, develop, and convince people that the project was good. It wasn't easy to get her signed. I A&R'd the record and spent a year convincing people. I even had her come into the office, and no matter if it were interns, assistants, media people, salespeople, I would just have her play her acoustic guitar and showcase her songs to anyone that would listen. I had 9 people standing around in my small office watching watching her play, this internal buzz building was happening for a year. What I chose to take away from this and what I read from it is that in the right circumstances, with the right collaborators and with the right song, Katy Perry can work. But she's not an immediate yes in any regard. When you strip away the artifice and you put her on a stage alone with a guitar, as she had to keep doing in the signing process, her talent is not clear enough to speak for itself, either from playing, singing, or songwriting. Katy really requires a performance, a character, that sense of humor to jazz her up and reach a full potential. So we're finally here at her debut. It took a lot of convincing to get the executives to agree to release I Kissed a Girl as Katy's official single, but it was strong-armed through and impacted radio in April of 2008, and it was pretty much an instant smash hit, topping the Hot 100 for 7 consecutive weeks, classified as a rock song, actually. It was co-written by Katy, Kathy Dennis, Dr. Luke, and Max Martin, and it was co-produced by Benny Blanco and Dr. Luke. Katy said the idea for the hook came into her head randomly when she woke up, and I can actually see that about it. It sounds like something you'd hum along to yourself while washing the dishes, which is the gold quality of a great pop song anyways. It's got live and programmed drums, which give it that polished pop rock feel, rather than the messiness and heaviness of an Alanis Morissette type song, which has more live instruments and session musicians. So, now the subject matter. Buy for clout was a real trend in pop music at the time, and I Kissed a Girl is the best example of this. Katy has been accused of queerbaiting in recent years when people look back on this, but to be honest, I think it's a pretty harmless song. It's really just saying, I kissed a girl and I liked it. And what's wrong with that? This was, however, very controversial to say in 2008. We're pre-gay marriage being legalized, remember? So it was kind of, you know, a bit of a moment. And when has a little controversy with the Christian community specifically ever really hurt a big pop song? It is kind of amazing that it's coming from a preacher's daughter, but that wasn't really part of her story at the time either way. She only kind of embraced that later on. The controversy with the song actually kind of went in every direction. The LGBT community was not exactly happy about the subject matter either, because they felt that she was just using her sexuality to get her places, so she sinks to crass, craven depths. And, like, that is true. Katy has admitted that there wasn't really a bisexual inspiration behind this song, and she was definitely trafficking in shock value to finally break through. She has told a million different versions of how this song was created and what inspired it. What I want to point out here is, do you see how she has to pull a stunt to get attention? Between this and You're So Gay, it's kind of interesting that she was baiting the gays in her first two singles, but you know what? They were great. I Kissed a Girl is a great pop song. Is it excellent? Well, no. If it wasn't about kissing a girl in 2008, it probably wouldn't have gone number one. There is also something to be said about how male gazy the performance of this song is. The music video features a very dolled up, almost pinup-like Katy Perry in corsets, suggestively kind of rolling around in bed and vaguely touching other women. It's very burlesque, Moulin Rouge-y, and it ends with her waking up in bed next to a man. In fact, there's actually no same-sex anything happening at all in this video. The suggestive boudoir aura permeates the album artwork too for One of the Boys, this kind of old-school Americana, sexy stay-at-home housewife vibe. Kesha is also in this video. Cricket, because of the later betrayal. As I mentioned, the Christians were very upset about this, but we don't need to give bigotry any airtime on Swiftologists, so to them I say, Shay never made anybody less gay. This song wound up getting a Grammy nomination, and should it have won? Maybe so. Maybe so. Maybe not, but maybe so. Katy then goes on the Warped Tour to promote this song and her upcoming record. If you're not familiar, this was a crucial launching pad for so many artists, specifically those in the pop punk and pop rock genres. Fall Out Boy, Paramore, and Katy Perry all cut their teeth performing on the Warped Tour. It was kind of like a rite of passage in live performance, like idol training for pop rock stars. The second single from One of the Boys is released in September of 2008, and it's Hot and Cold, another Max Martin, Dr. Luke, Benny Blanco number. It was also a top 5 single and a worldwide hit. I think the song's actually better than I Kissed a Girl, and it was briefly considered to be the lead single. This is honestly just a great pop song, and I think it shows a lot more personality and character than I Kissed a Girl. The music video for it specifically introduces us to the hilarity and the playfulness of Katy Perry, the pop star. She's doing her favorite things in this video. She's dressing up and doing physical comedy. That's her bag. This is the formula she follows for many of her music videos to come. It's also very young and hip in its verbiage. You change your mind like a girl changes clothes, you PMS like a bitch, I would know. Her vocal delivery on this is really good, and those breathy verses really contrast well with that shouty chorus. Someone call a doctor, got a case of the love bipolar. It's poetry. It's poetry, divas. The critics were pretty lukewarm on this one, surprisingly, kind of early on detecting that Katy's gag was always to do a silly bit. But nevertheless, it persisted as a huge hit, and this one kills on the dance floor at a wedding. This is also the beginning of Katy Perry, the product, and I think part of why her brand has weakened over time and actually cratered over the years is because she will sell out for just about anyone. She recorded a Simlish version of Hot and Cold for an expansion pack of The Sims 2. It's also featured in the Just Dance video game. It's clear that the record label has always been looking to maximize its return on investment with Katy. These things are good for promo kind of early on in her career, but I point them out now so that you can see how often often Katie is willing to shill. It gets annoying. It feels insincere. It leads us to the hollow, dead-eyed creature that we see on Woman's World now. I personally don't think that you necessarily need to explore all of one of the boys to understand what she was trying to do with it. All you really need to do is look at the singles and understand their sequencing of release. We have two silly, undeniable hits up top, the poppiest things that Katy Perry has to offer on this record. Then there is a slight heel turn to really show off those songwriter chops that Katy was trying to refine with mixed success, with a rare swing and hit on Thinking of You. This was one of the oldest songs on her record. I think it was co-written in the early 2000s with Butch Walker. The Alanis influence is very strong on this song. It's a soft rock ballad, which actually has some good lyrics. You said move on, where do I go? I guess second best is all I will know. But it also has insipid flop lyrics. You're like an Indian summer in the middle of winter, like a hard candy with a surprise center. This is a Katy Perry trademark. It is not a Katy Perry song without some humiliating lyric. The real trick here, for her at least, is to balance the obvious and obnoxious with some humor or at least some subtlety. She doesn't often get that balance right anymore, though there are some exceptions where she does really hit it out of the park. This music video further deepens the kind of angsty stay-at-home 50s housewife lore with literal scenes of Katy missing her man who has not returned from war. She does have this very kind of like alluring old Hollywood glam vibe, which gets much more hammed up over time. Katy's a sex symbol is really kind of essential to her early success, and aesthetics are important, especially in pop music. Often the visuals have just as much story to tell about the artist that you're encountering as the music does. Finally, they end up giving her the big budget that she really deserves for a music video on Waking Up in Vegas, which is one of my personal favorite Katy Perry songs. The conceit of the song is so Katy Perry. It's kitschy, it's silly, it's uncomplicated fun. Don't call your mother because now we're partners in crime, she says after a shotgun drunken wedding in Vegas. It's very The Hangover, but make it girly. And I love that about it. She's also in full glamour puss again in this video, literally dressed up like a Vegas showgirl. That's also a very iconic Americana image. Americana imagery was something that was very important to Katy at this early part of her career. She's also got her tits out at the Last Supper with an Elvis impersonator sitting right next to her. This might be one of her best music videos ever, actually. And guess who it was directed by? That's right, music video king Joseph Kahn. So though Thinking of You missed the top 10, Waking Up in Vegas snuck in at number 9, and it also brought the album back into the top 50. Let's talk about the actual release of the album itself, though. You know what's interesting? One of the Boys comes out before the second single is even released. That's right, they said, one hit song, I Kissed a Girl, and we're good to go. Let's just see how this rocks. The record comes out in June of 2008, and I think you can really clearly see the split between the undeniable hits, engineered with Dr. Luke, Max Martin, etc., and the more tepid demos that were brought over from Columbia in the collapse of her previous deal. There are a few good deep cuts here. I particularly like the title track, One of the Boys, and Fingertips is pretty good, but it's not particularly memorable beyond the singles, which are genuinely sensational. But I do think that the lyrical content on this record is pretty shallow. But that's not all the record is about. The record serves more as world building for Katy Perry, the pop star. And I think it's actually kind of irrelevant what the lyrical content of it is, as long as it's not really terrible. The point was, Katy Perry is hot, but she's also silly and she's also fun. And she can also make some songs that stick in your brain like toffee in your teeth. I think releasing the album before the second single even came out was kind of stupid because it only sold 47,000 copies in its first week, which was definitely a relative flop for the time, but it did debut at number 9, so within the top 10. Katy does promo for this record. She's on every morning show and every evening show doing these tunes. She does all the festivals. She attends the EMAs and the VMAs. She tours internationally in support of this record. Her live shows are really taking shape and being really fun, albeit they're kind of low budget. She has these kind of like weird blow up fruits and she's doing a lot of crowd work. I Kissed a Girl Live, for example, Finding a Girl to Kiss, heard of it. That Vans Warped Tour Idol Boot Camp really prepared her well for this moment. And something you can never take away from Katy Perry is that she is a worker. She shows up to perform. This was also a period of time where more was more. It paid off to be everywhere, especially as social media was really only just kind of like taking off and being recognized in the industry as a way to promote yourself. You were much more reliant on the traditional keys to the castle, which could only be offered to you by a label and a budget. Katy is also very pleasant and fun and affable as a personality. She comes across really well in interviews. She's funny, she's gorgeous, really what's not to like at this moment in time? So what's next? Well, let's take a look at what worked for Katy Perry on One of the Boys. Outlandish caricatures, highly stylized performance, funny sexual innuendos, and the undeniable hits. Now here's the thing. All the things that worked about One of the Boys were things that Katy couldn't necessarily construct or accomplish by herself. She needed the stylist, she needed the production designer, she needed the music video director, she needed the producers. Here's what didn't work about One of the Boys. Katy Perry, the singer-songwriter, nobody moved. There are, of course, people who will always say, I moved, but, you know, by and large, Thinking of You was the worst performing single and the best example of her being able to write a good ballad. It makes sense that her label would instead want to heavily invest in what worked instead of what they knew didn't work from years of trial and error before she landed at Capitol Records. I simply must interrupt for a brief moment to introduce you to a tool that has changed the way I make video essays, our returning sponsor, Perplexity. With that in mind, when life gets busy, we all need more efficiency. Millions of people are currently using Uber One to save on Uber Eats and Uber, and if you're an Uber One member, you can now access my research sidekick, Perplexity. Through October 31st, Uber One members in the United States and Canada can redeem a complimentary year of Perplexity Pro. That free year is a $200 value, by the way. Perplexity is revolutionizing how we search. Instead of scrolling through a list of blue hyperlinks, you get instant up-to-date answers with just a question or a quick search. This is enormously helpful for me when I'm doing background for a video essay. I need to start at the very beginning, but I don't want to read for hours and hours on end. I can get qualitative answers to questions like, when did Katy Perry fall off? Instead of trawling through a bunch of often irrelevant articles and blog posts to help me draw my own conclusions. Uber One members get access to two standout features with Perplexity that I really love. Perplexity Pro Search, which lets you break down your queries into smaller steps for more detailed and accurate results. And you also get AI model variety, which allows you to choose from advanced models like OpenAI's GPT-4, Anthropic's Claude 3 Opus, and Claude 3.5 Sonnet, or Perplexity's own Sonar model, which means that there's no need for multiple AI subscriptions. Perplexity gives you all the tools that you need in one place. Uber One members in the US and Canada can snag a free year of Perplexity Pro worth $200 through October 31st, 2024. Just use the link in my bio or scan the QR code on screen right now. Thank you again so much to Perplexity for sponsoring this video. Now let's get into the golden era. There was a time when Katy Perry had her finger on the pulse of what was going on. I know it's hard to believe because she's been giving hello fellow kids I'm just one of you for the past 10 years or so, Sophia the Robot vibes, but she was in her bag when she was making Teenage Dream. She had already solidified this creative synergy with Dr. Luke and Max Martin, and her A&R at Capitol introduced her to some new producers to bring a fresh perspective as well. Stargate, Tricky Stewart, and Rodney Jerkins, for example, who were definitely more urban-oriented producers. I do think that Katy has always been a little bit disconnected from what she thinks she's creating versus what she's actually making, because, for example, when she was talking about Teenage Dream, she said she was making a record about not just dancing. I like to get into the meaning, describing the lyrics as very honest and a bit more mature. To that I say, I want to see your peacock. TGIF. You're an alien. Your touch so foreign. Okay, whatever you say. But this disconnect between what she thinks she's doing and what she's actually doing is something that will circle back to haunt her later on. She almost entirely abandons the pop rock sound for a hardcore pop moment, sometimes bubblegum, veering disco and electronic at several different junctures throughout the tracklist. She was also the marquee artist at Capitol at this time, and because she was bringing in most of the money, they threw all of the money at her to go and make this project. And she was very intentional with it. She only cut songs that she really loved. She was a bit discerning about what made it on to the studio floor and what didn't. So there wasn't a lot of fat left over with Teenage Dream. In fact, to release a deluxe edition, she had to go and write some new songs for it. And the result of all this work is an incredible album cycle. I think Teenage Dream's importance is often overstated simply because everything she's done since pales in comparison, but it really has to be stressed how great this record was relative to Katy Perry and how perfectly it met the moment in which it arrived and how well Katy sold it. Here's an example of Katy having her finger on the goddamn pulse. She noted the success of Empire State of Mind and said, "You know what? The California girls need their own concrete jungle where dreams are made of moment." And the sonic contrast between both of these songs also really cleverly juxtaposes their characteristics as places as well. Empire State of Mind is harder, grittier, focused on ambition and achievement and dreams. California Girls is frothy, it's bubbly, it's silly, it's fun, it's a little more relaxed. And Katy was the spearhead of this concept. In fact, it was one of the last songs that she recorded for the record. She knew that the record wasn't done and she had a vision of Snoop Dogg on this song, and he came into the studio and recorded his verse in a mere 30 minutes. She was also, shockingly, inspired by music of the past. She was being referential. She was citing her references. She was kind of like, let's make this a pop version of a Prince song, and let's get a little house music up in there. You could travel the world, but nothing comes close to the Golden Coast. I mean, it's just charming. The song puts a smile on your face. It has that sing-songy, nursery rhyme type of chorus, so hot will melt your popsicle. And yes, the song is a little bit juvenile, it's a little bit vapid, but the packaging of it all and Katie's delivery makes you feel like she knows it's all a joke and that this is some sort of high-level bit or troll that she's performing. There's a smart, serious artist in there doing this deliberate performance of artifice, and that's what makes it so great. That turned out to not be the case. She got lost in the sauce, but it was that allure, I think, that really drove California Girls' success and made people in the music industry kind of sit up straighter and consider her more seriously as a pop star. California Girls debuts at number 2 in its first week, and then it goes number 1. Within 7 weeks, it sold over 2 million downloads and broke all kinds of records. Even the critics who begrudged its overt commercialism could not deny that this fizzy pop concoction of empty calories sure does stick with you. The visuals are also, I think, a really important part of Teenage Dream's dominance. It was a turn towards the absurd that she'd kind of highlighted and hinted at in Waking Up in Vegas, only on crack. She's also very much less suggestive and more overt about using sex to sell her music. In the music video for California Girl, she's wearing the iconic purple wig. She's posing butt naked on a puffy pink cloud, also where she would lay for the iconic album cover. The visual effects for this video were pretty groundbreaking. She's wearing a cupcake bra, shooting whipped cream out of her boobs, and flirting with a gingerbread man. In this video, Katie introduces us to Candyfornia, a demented kind of acid trip interpretation of the city that chewed her up, spat her out, and threw her to the top. If you look in the video as well, there are like little Easter eggs here and there. You can see the Capitol Records building and other kind of personally significant places that she visited on her road to success. Now we need to take a moment to talk about what is Katy Perry's greatest number of all time. Yes, I said it, of all time. The title track of this record, Teenage Dream. God, this is one of the most perfect pop songs ever created. I'm being so serious. It literally never gets old. Katy and her co-writer Bonnie McKee were really into Lolita. Okay, so they wanted to write a song about basically being a horny teen, which is really not what Lolita is about at all. So I don't know if they actually read the book. But anyway, that song was written and scrapped because it made no sense. And the newer version of it was largely spearheaded by Bonnie McKee, who was thinking and reminiscing about her own teenage loves. She was envisioning Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, and Benny Blanco, who co-produced it, had given Katie and Bonnie the instruction of make it more teen after he had heard the original cut. And the idea of agonizing over the teenage condition came up spontaneously between Bonnie and Benny Blanco. While producing it, Max Martin said, "I wish we could bottle this feeling." And that is the perfect way to describe this song. In an article for Slate, Owen Pallett uses music theory to describe why the song is so addictive. He says, "This song is all about suspension, not in the voice leading sense, but in the emotional sense, which listeners often associate with exhilaration, being on a roller coaster, which is a tension created by the tonal interplay of the chords and the melody." If you can believe this, and this shocked me when I went back into the archives to double check, this was not met with acclaim. The Atlantic called Teenage Dream annoying and incoherent. I would like to circle back with this writer and ask if they still felt that way, and if they didn't get laid in high school, why are you making it everyone else's problem? Retroactively, Teenage Dream is often pointed to as the most memorable song in her career. It has entered the canon of perfect pop songs right alongside Britney Spears' Baby One More Time. It's simply that iconic. It was also the second number one single for Teenage Dream, and the music video, I thought, was actually a lot more stripped down here. There were no characters, there was no absurdity. The song was just about feeling like you're young again, a very powerful, strong nostalgia, and the video definitely evokes that. The third single from Teenage Dream was another chart topper, Firework. Now, this song is very annoying and grating to listen to in 2024. It was sang at the presidential inauguration in 2021, so it's kind of one of those ubiquitous celebratory songs that just gets trotted out whenever there's a moment, and it's also the first Stargate-produced song from the record to get released as a single. Firework was not really well-received by the critics, but the song became an anthem for the It Gets Better project, and she dedicated the music video to this effort. A song with a pop diva screaming about fireworks is always going to enter the gay canon. The music video actually very explicitly depicts some gays and other down-and-out people suddenly finding themselves and feeling hopeful and optimistic. Keep in mind that this is the album's third single and she's only just getting started. So now the record's been out for a while, and here's a brilliant stroke of marketing architected by Katie and her team. If you want to extend an album's campaign and make new hits out of already released songs, launch a remix with a feature. Kanye West's inclusion on ET helped propel it to the top of the charts with a sleek, futuristic music video. Is this a great song? Well, no. But at this point, the Katy Perry effect was in full force. She was everywhere. It was like an avalanche. This song also broke all kinds of records, lest we forget that Kanye was basically a god at this period of time, so a flurry of interest from his fans certainly helped the song climb the charts and raise Katy's profile even more. She took another sharp turn with the album's fifth single, Last Friday Night, which I think is actually very charming and one of my favorite songs on Teenage Dream, though it does have some clunker lines. Think I Need a Ginger Ale, that was such an epic fail. It's dated. But it's not a Katy Perry song without a lyrical clunker. We know this. Katy also made full use of the medium of a music video to make this song pop, and it was stacked with celebrity cameos. It's like a prehistoric Bad Blood. I I think she actually did something really clever here by asking Rebecca Black to star in this video. It was, after all, a song about Friday, and Rebecca Black was notoriously the internet's laughingstock after her cringe song went viral. This was really pre-influencers being mainstream and pre-viral trends being hopped on by celebrities at a moment's notice all the time to promote stuff. So it felt very much that Katie was like ahead of the curve here, a real tastemaker. And the video also features Kevin McHale and Darren Criss from Glee, another hugely popular show at the time that was also helping to extend the reign of Teenage Dream by covering Katy Perry's songs on a regular basis. Those Glee covers were going to number one on iTunes all the time. And of course, with all of this hullabaloo, Last Friday Night went number one. And this is more than a year after Teenage Dream officially came out. Isn't that crazy? The sixth and final single from the standard edition of Teenage Dream was the one that got away, the only ballad released with a very moving acoustic version. This failed to get number one, but did chart at number three. All right, we've talked about the rollout. Now let's discuss Teenage Dream's cultural impact. Teenage Dream is a wildly fun, lively, but very uneven pop record. Its singles are so huge that they make you think the album was better than it actually was. I'm not saying that it was bad by any stretch of the imagination, but it is quite dated, and some of the lyricism is corny to the point of being, again, insipid rather than clever or funny. Peacock is a bit of an embarrassing highlight here. Circle the Drain is just quite dull. Pearl is an average power ballad. E.T. is actually not a very good song. There are two deep cuts that I really like and want to point to here. Deep cuts that are good are rare to find in Katy Perry's discography. Hummingbird Heartbeat has this chorus that soars, and I love Not Like the Movies too, which I think is probably her most affecting ballad other than Wide Awake. Overall, the intention of this album was to sell and to chart. That was the heart of the record. There isn't really a story or a soul to the narrative here, nor is there even really a coherent story or narrative to speak of. And that's okay, because Teenage Dream was really good at doing its own thing, which was having fun and doing it big. Anne Powers describes Katy Perry's artistic limitations really well in her review of Teenage Dream. She wrote, "More than her Christian background or the chick lit limits to her take on sexual liberation, what makes Perry a controversial figure is her essential hollowness." Again, circling back to my original point, who is Katy Perry and what is she trying to sell me? This is a critique that has plagued her throughout her career that she has not been sufficiently creative enough to dispel. Every attempt that she makes at sincerity and authenticity on subsequent records falters, and not only because it's not good, mostly because it's not interesting. And we can often tell that the artist isn't interested in the product either. Katy Perry is artifice. Her whole project is about maximalism. But unfortunately, the culture didn't linger on maximalism for very long. But that still doesn't take away all that this record accomplished. 5 number one singles, only the second album in history to do this, most platinum singles from one album, longest streak of number ones on mainstream top 40, diamond certified for 10 million albums sold in the USA, and she kept it going too. That is the crazy part of it all. She managed to crank out another year of wonder and fascination with Candyland by releasing Teenage Dream, The Complete Confection, with two singles that also topped the charts at number one and number two respectively, Part of Me and Wide Awake. Both of these songs and the movie that accompanied them, Part of Me, charted the collapse of her marriage during the biggest career high of her life. The intrigue and the breakdown of her very public relationship with another very public person, Russell Brand, helped propel further interest in her and kept this album present in the mind's eye for 2 years. Though Teenage Dream is a pretty great pop album, if we're assessing it based on the music alone, looking at the body of work as an artistic statement without all the pomp and circumstance of Katy's visual persona, character, and performance, it's just good pop music. It's not exceptional. It's not anything different. A lot of Katy's success is based around, again, being in the right place at the right time with the right people. And that helps to explain why not only Teenage Dream was so massive, but also why she has been completely unable to replicate its success ever since. The stars have not aligned for her in such a fortuitous way subsequently, and her raw talent and artistry simply not powerful enough to garner the same kind of respect. Teenage Dream was released in the middle of Obama's first term as president, and there was a genuine sense of hope in the air. Bouncing back from the 2008 financial crisis, his campaign centered around hope. And there was plenty of hope and optimism on the peppy, sickeningly sweet Teenage Dream. I would take Firework as the perfect example of the early 2010s pop landscape. Baby, you're a firework. Come on, let your colors burst. It's simple, it's straightforward, it's optimistic, it's not thinking too deeply. Teenage Dream is also, as we know, a visual assault on all fronts. There's so much going on. The music itself is arresting too. It demands that you listen to it. And it's quite noisy. Conspicuous consumption returned in a big way as the economy started to right itself, and social media platforms introduced a new way for young people to flaunt their disposable income. Obama's presidency is often called the pop culture presidency because of how he was received more as a celebrity than as a politician, both at home and abroad. There was a kind of normalization of luxury lifestyles around this time. There was no longer a need to hide away your riches for the sake of the common suffering man. Katy was a millennial artist making music for millennials. This was the era of experiential marketing with that excessive attitude. Her CD was literally scented like cotton candy. You didn't just want to buy the music, you wanted to buy into Katy's world. And Katy was basically a walking billboard at this time too. She would sell her soul to the highest bidder. During this time, she was a spokesperson for proactive skincare, GHD styling tools, Adidas, Pop Chips. She launched a fragrance brand. There was so much product placement in her music videos. And now there's nothing wrong with securing your bag. If anything, Katie's marketing strategy with Teenage Dream that went on to include a deluxe version, remixes, and a tour movie to launch the deluxe version made one thing very clear. You don't have to rely on music to make money as an artist. The streaming era was on the horizon, and Katie was diversifying her income streams. Get your bag. But excessive product placement and brand collaboration can be pretty disastrous for your personal brand in the long run. There is a perceived inauthenticity when you're always plugging something and it doesn't feel aligned with who you are or what you do. And nobody really likes the feeling of being sold to. There is also the risk of becoming known for the products that you shill rather than the music that you make. Luckily for Katie, she was still making good music at this time, but there were a few years when Katie was at the height of her powers, or still in a golden age at least, where she was busier doing product placements and focusing on business endeavors instead of making music. That harmed her in the long run. A key to a successful brand partnership also is to be incredibly selective about who and what you work with to protect your brand. Taylor Swift, for example, not to bring her back, but she's my point of reference, has taken on very few endorsements and has almost never been the face of a product. That's leaving a lot of money on the table, but it allows Taylor Swift to be defined in the public eye much more by her music than her image, by her literal face and personality. There's also the risk of whatever you're endorsing reflecting poorly on you. By working with Dr. Luke, Katy Perry, for example, is effectively endorsing him, and that has had a disastrous impact on her public image. So what's next for Katy Perry after Teenage Dream? After touring the world, starring in your own movie, topping the charts, what's next for you? Katy had just over a year to prepare for her next act, which she found very hard to do, which I'm not surprised. She knew that there would be no second Teenage Dream, and she even said that it would be stupid to try and follow it with more of the same. But what she ended up creating next, Prism, her third studio album, is kind of neither here nor there to me. It's not a heel turn away from Teenage Dream or a direct copy of it, but it is kind of more of the same. She says that she was painting with different colors and had different textures showcased in the songs, but to me, this is actually one of her more generic efforts. It just kind of sounded like everything that was on the radio at the time, with a significantly less amount of that signature Katy Perry wink behind it. There was enough goodwill following Teenage Dream and curiosity about how the hell she would follow it up for Prism to do pretty well regardless of its quality. Initially, she said that she was writing something darker, but that vision of the album fell apart a few months into the recording process with Greg Wells and Greg Kurstin. She was going through the divorce from Russell Brand and had just found a new love with John Mayer and decided all of a sudden that she needed to let the light in. I suspect that the label said, "We want hits and we want them now, and you need to stop writing the sad stuff and get back to the hit factory." And that is when she linked back up with Dr. Luke and Max Martin and Benny Blanc. So what exactly is Katy Perry trying to say on this record? We don't know. We do not know. The concept for Prism is really confusing, and thus begins her weird inclination to over-explain a simple concept and confuse the audience about what to expect from her. She billed Prism as kind of a self-help Madonna Ray of Light style rebrand. Only to the public, Prism is not a rebrand. It's bright and airy and pastel, sure, which is kind of just more of the same from Teenage Dream, except a little bit more boring, a little bit less technicolor. The public didn't actually get to witness the falling apart of the first iteration of the album, so trying to get on board with this reunification or salvation kind of felt a bit contextless. The album is full of kind of confusing, hokey, generic, Californian rich people spiritualism. She's talking about her Saturn's return and her third eye and mantras. There isn't a lot of substance. She did, however, manage to score some huge hits, and Prism's album cycle was launched with a bang. There was the iconic showdown between Lady Gaga's single Applause and Katy Perry's Roar to see who of the biggest divas would out-diva the other and snag the number one spot, and Katy Perry did with Roar. You know what Katy's actually really good at, surprisingly, and I've noticed this? Teasing. Her teaser for Change to the Rhythm was great. Even Woman's World had kind of an interesting tease. For Roar, she posted a video featuring her burning the iconic Teenage Dream blue wig. She's hinting here at a total reinvention, shedding her character and returning to her truer real self that we haven't yet seen. She's leaning heavy into the old Katy can't come to the phone right now. There's a literal funeral for her candy cane dress. Roar is released in March 2013, and it's produced again by Dr. Luke and Max Martin. It's a pretty bog standard, uplifting pop song about standing up for yourself and, you know, roaring. It's got the millennial whoop in the chorus. There are some great ad-libs in the outro. It was destined to be a hit. And yet, despite advertising this record as the death of the old Katy Perry, in the music video for Roar, she's Jane of the Jungle, being sexy and flirting with the wild animals. It's legit just more of the same. But this time, there's something a little bit more soulless about it. It seems like she was really going through something and was perhaps rather tired after keeping such a punishing schedule and going through a divorce, but the whole I'm enlightened and healing thing just wasn't landing right because I don't think that it was true. Roar went number one, but its consecutive streak of being at number one was broken by another viral sensation who found herself in the right place at the right time. Miley Cyrus with Wrecking Ball. So Roar did very, very well. It's her highest selling digital download ever, and it carried Prism on its back. I think the second single is always a really pivotal moment, however, for a pop star. A great second single can truly enhance the hype for an upcoming album. Please, 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 following Espresso, for example, or it can kind of stall the momentum and dull its shine. Unfortunately, the bizarre second single choice from Prism is Unconditionally, which is an unremarkable, wailing song about loving someone with no strings attached. She says that she wrote the song after she took a trip to see poor children in Madagascar. Girly. And then she performed it in Japanese cosplay, literally dressed up as a geisha, instantly drawing ire for cultural appropriation. And this was when those conversations were really reaching a fever pitch in the culture, with Miley Cyrus's We Can't Stop spearheading those kinds of discussions. This song is just not good. It has a really strange syntax as well, the way she says unconditionally, unconditionally. Max Martin loves to make words sound weird, but this is a bridge too far even for him. And the music video is also really boring, just slow-mo shots of her looking pretty. I think she was trying to do another firework here, but it does not have the vernacular, and it failed to crack the top 10. And then the record comes out, netting her highest opening week sales of her entire career with 286,000 copies sold, number one hit. But it paled in comparison to Teenage Dream quality-wise. The resounding attitude towards this record from the industry was, well, okay, it was truly a nothing burger. Though there were some good and memorable moments. Walking on Air is a fun, deep house, disco deep cut that really should have been the second single. Legendary Lovers is all right, but there is some shocking filler on this record. I want to take a moment to talk about Katy Perry's songwriting, because I think this is what lets her down and causes her a lot of humiliation later on. She learned how to write her best songs, the ones we know and love, with two producers and writers who really are not that concerned about the lyrics themselves. Max Martin is known to embrace nonsensical words and sentences if they align with his melodic math, and Dr. Luke is more similarly driven by a feeling, not a sentiment, and this leaves someone like Katy Perry, if there's no other writer in the room, to do all the heavy lifting lyrically. And what does she have to say when it comes to writing? Well, not anything interesting, hardly ever. Not every performer has to be a songwriter, but the common denominator between many of the flops that we'll go on to see from this point out, especially when she ditches Dr. Luke and Max Martin doesn't want to work with her anymore, is that Katy Perry is writing the songs. She's the common denominator of why they're being bad. As a writer, Katy leans into very rudimentary metaphor and obvious and literal imagery. She's very direct and childlike. There is nothing subtle about her in any sense of the word as a writer, and she has not learned the writerly trick of show, don't tell. Describe how you feel, paint the picture, create an ambiance, don't just say it. Her meaningful and deep songs are full of the kind of platitudes that you find in the signage aisle of Home Goods. Let's look at By the Grace of God, the emotional center point on this record, if there is one, on Prism. This is one of the only songs not to feature a hitmaker, Dr. Luke or Max Martin, as a co-writer, and she's got Greg Wells here instead. He is the architect of that first version of Prism that ended up falling apart. The song opens kind of interestingly enough. Was 27 surviving my return of Saturn? A long vacation didn't sound so bad. But then it immediately leans into cliche. Was full of secrets, locked up tight like Iron Mountain, running on empty, so out of gas. We don't get to know later on in the song what those secrets might be or why she was indeed running on empty. One can assume she's talking about Teenage Dream or perhaps her divorce, but it's not immediately clear. There's one really, really good line in this entire song. We were living on a fault line and I felt the fault was all mine. That's a very elegant way to express the ways in which that you beat yourself up after failing to make a broken relationship built on an unstable foundation work. That is an insight. But instead of living in that discomfort, we go straight back to the Home Goods signage aisle in the chorus. I picked myself back up. I put one foot in front of the other and I looked in the mirror. There is no space for Katy Perry the human here. We simply, after that one good line, have to revert back to this dead-eyed firework, Home Goods signage empowerment. There was another iconic song that kind of solidified Prism as a bit more of a legacy than any of her following albums, Dark Horse. Though the album met a lukewarm reception, luckily for Katy, she had Dark Horse locked and loaded and ready to go as a single. I hate this song. It's like all the worst elements of 2013 music in one song, but I know that people love it and it's a Katy Perry classic. I just don't really like it very much. The song ended up being a bit of a headache for her due to a huge copyright lawsuit that went on for a number of years after. But the two biggest hits from this era say very little about the album itself. Roar, I'll give her that, sure, tangentially, but Dark Horse, it's truly nonsensical. This love will make you levitate like a bird without a cage, please. It's songs like these where I'm like, okay, ChatGPT wrote this, or a bunch of men sat around in a room and said, what do young people want to hear? And then just started spitting. In my opinion, the era kind of fizzles out after Dark Horse. It certainly doesn't end with a triumphant reissue and two more hits. Birthday and This Is How We Do are the final singles. She's definitely trying to ape her Teenage Dream playbook here by trying to make and force a viral trend out of the birthday music video, dressing up in an old lady suit and surprising people at their parties, and then making a music video about emojis for This Is How We Do. Birthday is actually kind of a pretty good song, but it came way too late in the album cycle to capture for attention, and Katie's grasp on cultural relevance was really waning. Katie creates a heinous remix of This Is How We Do with Riff Raff, again borrowing from the Teenage Dream playbook, and wears cornrows on the single cover. She then embarks on the Prismatic World Tour, which is her most successful tour to date. So we're in 2013, 2014, and where is Katie at with the public now? Well, she's putting her career on ice. She's booked to perform at the halftime show and simply knocks it out of the park. This is a great performance. And this is the kind of career milestone, like a Vegas residency, that Katy Perry was born for. Outlandish, over-the-top production, meant to appeal to as many people as possible without alienating a core audience of straight men. The halftime show this year actually had higher viewership than the Super Bowl, and it remains the most watched halftime show of all time, with 100 million live viewers. Here's something I want to quickly talk about when I discuss why going on a break is really detrimental for her. I noticed that Katy doesn't really have a solid fan base. There are, of course, delusional stands for every artist, and the Katy Cats have been descending on me en masse for days now, but the evidence of a strong home base of people who support your music even when you flop or who will actively stan you is notably lesser for Katy Perry than it is for other artists. And I think that this is the peril of simply swinging too high. A friend to all is a friend to none. A pop star to all is a number one diva to none. There was no real reason to get invested in the Katy Perry story, especially as authenticity started to become more and more important and artifice more and more side-eyed. As I mentioned before, Katy is really bad at reading the room. She can never really work out what the public wants from her. And I think that indecision in herself translates all the way through her music and her public image. We are confused by Katy Perry because she is confused. We want to like her. We have all these fond memories of Teenage Dream. Can't she just be like that again? Well, no, she can't, because the industry changed and then the world changed. And while all of this was happening, she didn't change. The halftime show was the last time Katy Perry was truly relevant in the zeitgeist for a good reason, and it was 10 years ago. Katy's next studio album would not appear until 2017. But between those two titles, Prism and Witness, there's a four-year gap and one new president. Remember how I suggested earlier that diluting your brand with too many offshoots from your hero product might circle around and weaken your hero product? That's kind of what happened in the meantime between Prism and Witness. There's a new perfume. Katy's in the Smurfs 2, which is critically panned. She's the face of a H&M holiday campaign. She's breaking up with John Mayer. She's launching her own record label that has yet to produce a successful artist. She's on The Kroll Show. She gets interviewed for a documentary about her ex-husband. She releases a short-lived mobile game app called Katy Perry Pop. And where are the Katy Cats in this period of time? Who is servicing them? Who is keeping them hungry for more music? They don't want more apps. They don't want more H&M campaigns. They want the music. And if you ignore them for long enough, pop is a game of relevant. They will turn away. In this protracted off-season, Katy is also locked in a pretty high-profile feud with Taylor Swift, who gets to control the narrative, mostly because Katy's off doing all of what I mentioned before. As a pop star, yielding space like that to other artists to fill in the gap you've left is not the smartest idea. I think Katy absolutely needed a break after Teenage Dream. She rushed into Prism with not enough time to find something to say, and she burned out in that era. I think she should have taken 2 years to regroup and come back with something stronger. This delayed rest period that she had to take after Prism and before Witness kept her out of the game for too long and left her unfamiliar with a playbook that had totally changed in her absence. The average lifespan of a pop star's peak popularity is really only 2 to 5 years anyway. Anything longer than that is an exception, but I do think that Katy Perry's legacy could have been stronger if she had played her hand a little bit differently at this very crucial point in her career. So I mentioned earlier that the world had changed and Katy didn't know what to do about that. And let's get into this as we dive into Witness. Some key differences in the world that contributed to Witness seeming wildly out of touch were, first and foremost, the rise of streaming. It wasn't about selling downloads and records anymore. Streaming services suddenly held as much power as record labels, and a streaming rollout was a separate marketing strategy that needed to be considered. The taste of the public had also changed. After years of sugar-coated pop and dance-heavy tracks dominating the airwaves, the US market veered sharply towards hip-hop in the wider landscape. This trickle-down effect was definitely felt by even the most traditional artists. Reputation is a good example of an artist adapting to a trend without necessarily getting lost in it, for example. Ariana Grande also navigated this influence very well. We also have new stars who are native to the drop culture, pivot away from pre-release singles, lead singles, the formula of a record rollout. Cardi B and Post Malone broke through in non-linear ways, garnering sleeper hits without having to do remixes and acrobatics. Song structures also started to evolve to accommodate their new home base, streaming services becoming shorter, with earlier hooks designed to capture the listener more quickly and encourage them to replay. Then there was the political climate. 2017 was wildly different from 2014. The Obama years of optimism, hope, and change were well and truly gone. A polarizing election in 2016 left the world reeling at the prospect of Donald Trump taking the title of Commander-in-Chief. There was also the Me Too movement, and this will become crucial in Katy's demise later on, exposing the bad behavior by men in the entertainment industry, uncovering decades of abuse, and dismantling unspoken rules like the casting couch. The Me Too movement brought a renewed scrutiny to a lawsuit filed by Kesha against against one of Katie's closest collaborators, Dr. Luke, accusing him of sexual assault, gender violence, emotional abuse, and battery. Kesha was moved to do this to get out of her recording contract and to stop having to work with her abuser. Dr. Luke fought this bitterly in court. Katy Perry would end up being dragged into the lawsuit, having to disagree with an assertion Kesha made about Katy's own experiences with Dr. Luke in a text message to Lady Gaga. Katy has never actually really addressed her role in Kesha's protracted battle with Dr. Luke, but she has very clearly taken a side by electing to work with him proudly on 143. I think it's important to note that it's not just Kesha who's had uncomfortable experiences with Dr. Luke. Other artists have come forward to say how difficult he was to work with. Kelly Clarkson notably rejected a writing credit that she earned on a song that she wrote with him because she wanted nothing to do with him and felt forced by her label to work with someone who always made her feel uncomfortable. Another cultural shift that Katy had to navigate and would soon learn the pitfalls of was cancel culture, where anyone could lose their career essentially for any perceived slight against liberalism in this conservative dawn. The world was really, really different, and Katy Perry wanted to chime in. So how did she dip her toes back into, music, that thing she'd forgotten how to do? When you haven't released music in a couple of years and you're plotting your big pop comeback, it's probably not a good idea to put out a platitudinal ballad about uniting the world for the Olympics before a disastrous presidential election. At this moment in time, what was popular in culture was to be very, very clear about what you meant. Speak intelligently or let someone smarter talk for you. I don't necessarily agree with that mentality, but it was very dogmatic at the time. People were scared and starting to understand the negative impact of saying whatever you wanted on social media with no thought. And that's where Katy Perry's comeback single, Rise, kind of gets lost in the fray. Stars were becoming more charged and potent with their statements, and Katy Perry's Rise fell like a lead balloon. Just another hollow addition from the woman who has been trying to sell me pop chips for the last 3 years. The election comes and goes, and Katy winds up being one of the first pop divas to enter a record cycle in the middle of the Trump presidency. At this point, it was like you had to comment on American politics, and if you didn't, you were considered a covert white supremacist. Just ask Taylor Swift how her silence worked for her. Not well. Katy took the opposite approach and actually for a brief period of time generated some true excitement. She released a kind of iconic teaser for her new lead single, dragging around a disco ball tied on a chain to her ankle. Song is, of course, Chained to the Rhythm, produced by Max Martin. And she did something on the day that this was released that she would come to rue. She tweeted, "We're gonna call this era purposeful pop." People had really been ragging on artists like Taylor Swift, who they perceived to be apolitical, for irresponsibly staying quiet on Trump's election and all of the new problems that the world had encountered. Katy Perry seemed like she was kind of taking a shot at Taylor here. Remember, the Cold War was still on and people were excited about the prospect of a pop girl coming up with something cool, current, and nuanced to say about the world, a place that had become concerning and confusing for most of us. But did we want Katy Perry to rise from the ashes and say that? Chain to the Rhythm is about as political as Witness ever manages to get. It's kind of like the standard millennial white liberal woman's response to Trump's election. "I can't believe that Hillary didn't win. What the hell, guys? Shame on you." Here's a sample of some of the lyrics. "Are we tone deaf? Keep sweeping it under the mat. Thought we could do better than that. I hope we can. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? These words are so hollow. They say absolutely nothing about the matters at hand, nor do they even address any one issue directly." All of a sudden, it started to seem like maybe Katy Perry was using purposeful pop as a strategy to sell us songs, which she was, except we weren't buying. Gag of it all is that Chain to the Rhythm isn't even a bad song. I kind of turn it up sometimes. But the guise it premiered under was suspicious. People were not convinced that it was substantial, and it wasn't. It peaked at number 4 on the Hot 100, and that was the last time that Katy Perry was going to see of the top 10 forever. Literally forever. Let's take a look around and see what else was being released during this period of time. We are riding the high of Beyoncé's iconic visual album, Lemonade. Formation, the song and video had a very clear political message. It's an incredibly poignant portrait of Black American life, touching on issues like police brutality and the failed government response to Hurricane Katrina. And did Beyoncé ever have to sit there and explain what she was trying to do with Formation and Lemonade? Or did the art just speak for itself because it was so imbued with purpose? To make purposeful pop, you gotta have a purpose. When you compare a statement like Formation to the nonsense that you see on Witness, it really highlights how shoddy, cynical, and inadequate Katy Perry had become. And here's the other issue with the way Katy went about releasing Witness. She would not shut up. She just kept talking and talking and talking. She has foot-in-mouth disease. Over-explaining this record to the point where when it came out, people were genuinely baffled as to how her mind could conceive that this slop would usher in a new era of purposeful pop. She kept explicitly saying that the record was a response to the new political climate without actually responding to anything. As one of my favorite music writers, Lindsay Zolatz, wrote in her 2017 review of Witness, Katy Perry has been faltering so publicly that she's become an object of morbid fascination. It was a career car crash, except Katy Perry was fully in the driver's seat. This wasn't a Britney Spears moment where a young starlet is driven to distraction, or a Taylor Swift Snakegate moment, which is a gotcha prompted by Kim Kardashian. This was a completely avoidable and self-inflicted legacy sabotage. So Katy continues to tout the purposeful pop nonsense and fatefully cuts all her hair off. I don't really understand people's obsession with her haircut and saying that it was the root of her downfall, because the music was the root of the downfall. I actually think this hair looks kind of good on her. It's just unfortunate that this hairstyle and color is synonymous with Ellen DeGeneres. The next single from Witness was Bon Appetit. And if you've ever heard this song, you know that there's nothing purposeful about it. Got me spread like a buffet. Bon Appetit. It was panned by critics and immediately detected as also not convincing. Not only was the product bad, she actually was not selling it well. It was like Katy Perry on autopilot. She, of course, talked herself into another verbal trap, describing Witness as, wait for it, a 360-degree liberation record. Bon Appetit representing sexual liberation. Oh girl, put your shoes on. Your second single's not even cracking the top 40. Here's another example of Katy talking a lot and saying nothing. This is her describing what the album cover of Witness means. The eye symbolizes the third eye, representing heightened awareness and perception. The eye in the mouth represents how I communicate my consciousness and experiences through music, highlighting that witnessing is a reciprocal experience between me and my audience. Whatever that means, whatever that means. So the songs aren't landing, and she's also starting to become the laughingstock of the internet due to a string of honestly inexplicable decisions. The worst of all was probably the 96-hour live stream. The conceit of Witness is being seen, but at this point, it seems like Katy was personally overwhelmed and stressed out by the impending flop of her upcoming record, and it was the worst possible moment to train a camera lens on her face and capture every move she made for multiple days on end. She went viral, all right. The stream picked up traction, but it was morbid curiosity. It had nothing to do with the music. Here's a non-exhaustive list of all the nonsense that she did on this live stream before the album came out. Ranked her ex-boyfriends based on who the best lover was, broke down in a painfully revealing therapy session that shouldn't have been on camera, where she basically laid out why she seemed so lost as a public figure, because she was lost. She discusses her much-hated haircut and how it meant a lot to her, and it was upsetting that other people didn't like it. She feels a huge disconnect between Katy Perry, the person, and Katherine Hudson, the human being, and she was not able to reconcile that difference. She had an uncomfortable sit-down with an activist to discuss her cultural appropriation. She chatted with RuPaul about Christianity. She tried and failed to reconcile one-sidedly with Taylor Swift. She had a dinner party with Caitlyn Jenner, who espoused Trumper nonsense, and she asked an astrophysicist if math had anything to do with science. And it all culminated with a live stream where she performed the highlights from Witness, and nobody moved. Nobody moved. Swish Wish is released as the third single, and again, the timing of this is not great. At this point, the Taylor Swift feud had been brewing for 3 years, and Katy had already lost by not saying anything when it was happening. Her clapback is honestly humiliating, filled with burns that barely singe. You're about as cute as an old coupon expired. It's very ironic that in this song she was singing about how, you know, other people need to be kissing her ring, as she completely lost her grasp on cultural relevance. She then has a disastrous performance on SNL, another viral moment of people being like, what the hell happened to Katy Perry? Who is this cyborg mimicking the Backpack Kid with an Ellen DeGeneres haircut? What does she want from us? She hosts the VMAs and is overshadowed by Taylor Swift's Look What You Made Me Do music video launch. She couldn't win. She was suffering under the eye of Tay Voodoo, to be fair, but this album rollout was insane. And so the gag is, Witness isn't the absolute car crash that it's often remembered as. It's very boring and forgettable, but it's not full of the kind of tripe we've been getting from 143. I think the title track is catchy enough. Roulette is kind of fun, but there is absolutely nothing purposeful about this pop. It is baffling to me that she billed it as the musical anthem of wokeness, because this song is mostly about like failing relationships and wanting to feel connected and being lonely. And this record is living proof that Max Martin can only do so much of the heavy lifting. He can create the track, but if you can't come up with a good concept or write good lyrics, the song is not going to automatically be good or a hit just because he's there. This is also the first record where Dr. Luke is completely absent from the record, and we can assume this is because of his bad reputation at the time. Witness is full of those horrible Katy Perry lyrical clunkers, but it has none of those bulletproof hooks or cheeky innuendos to mask them. I don't F with change, but lately I've been flipping coins a lot. On a heart-wrenching ballad, she writes, "Into me, you'll see. You broke me wide open. Open sesame. Is this intimacy? Like, this is just drivel. It's it's nonsense. Here are some notable reviews. From Consequence, Witness has great singles, forgettable filler, and songs that go clunk. From The Telegraph, and this is a read. The more time you spend with each song, the more it sounds like a variation of something you've heard done better before. A formula in search of a hook. I couldn't have said it better myself. But you know what? The stunt marketing and the residual power of Teenage Dream still propelled Witness to number one, but this would be her last opportunity to capitalize on the goodwill of a different decade. Katy Perry is no longer a relevant artist after this point. It's kind of hard to overstate just how swiftly she dismantled her career and her position in the mind's eye as a true diva or an icon. One doesn't really need to be relevant to stay iconic, you just need to have enough iconic moments to offset your floppage. At this point, with 143 out in the world, Teenage Dream and One of the Boys are not strong enough to counteract the middling to terrible results of the rest of her music. 2 out of 7 good albums, not a high winning streak. It's at this point that Katy Perry starts to spin out, and I think that one of the most important parts of pop stardom is being efficient, communicating the message of your art clearly and directly, putting yourself in the best position to promote it, releasing it, and then crucially, taking some time away to regroup and let people miss you. Katy is not very good at artistic efficiency. Career after Witness is sputtering, and there are one-off singles launched here and there that never amount to a full project. She did not follow up this colossal flop with another album for 3 years, which allowed the public too much time for this humiliating version of the cringe and try-hard Katy Perry to settle in their imagination. Plus, during this period of time, Katy continued to act like a billboard instead of an artist. In fact, she did many things that artists historically past their prime often do. She was a judge on American Idol, she had a Las Vegas residency. These are not necessarily things that artists do at the height of their powers, and it's okay to do those things, and it's unreasonable to expect a peak to go on forever, but again, I think Katy didn't have to do that this early in her career if she had just paid more attention to advancing her craft. When you think about it, there really has been no artistic growth in her skill or her songwriting or her hit-making since Teenage Dream was released. To be fair to her, it also seemed for a while that she just wasn't interested in pop stardom anymore, and that's totally fine. What confuses me about Katy Perry most of the time is that I can't tell if she wants to be a pop star or not. She is quite half-hearted about it, and frankly, either dishonest or disinterested about promoting her work, which makes me feel disinterested in it too. So in the interim period between Witness and her fifth album, Smile, she's Katy Perry the Billboard. She's releasing one-off singles here and there, like 365. She's cameoing in Taylor's music video after they make up and put their feud aside. The last opportunity that I really saw for a Katy Perry comeback was in this very brief Droplet era, kickstarted by the effervescent Never Really Over, released in May 2019. It seemed like, miraculously, Katy Perry was well and truly back. This is the first Katy Perry song since Teenage Dream to me that had that special "I wish I could bottle this feeling" effect. It's produced by Zedd, and there is an emotional resonance to the lyrics and delivery of this song that felt authentic. She'd gotten back together with Orlando Bloom again after years of being on again, off again. And this song is about that universal feeling. You know, what if the one that got away is right around the corner? Everybody has that person in their life who you think could maybe interrupt your wedding and you might actually change your mind for. The lyrics are simple. 2 years and just like that, my head still takes me back. I thought it was done, but I guess it's never really over. The delivery of that is so gorgeous, and it has an incredible tongue-twisting hook too. You'll notice on Never Really Over that the writing is kept very simple. She's not trying to be funny. She's not trying to be kitschy. It's sincere without being obvious. It's also her first top 20 hit in years. But then she fumbles the bag. She has no project attached to Never Really Over, no plans, despite having this big budget music video with a really promising visual direction. She's not setting the stage for a comeback. There's no reason for an audience to get really invested in this new vision of Katy Perry when we don't even know if it's going to stick around. And she also barely promotes this song. This is your first hit in years, and you can't book SNL. She performs a bathroom rendition of the song, but isn't really giving interviews or promoting it heavily, again, because there was no project in mind. She called into the Zach Sang show and said, "I haven't really committed to calling this an album or making it an album. I've never been able to just put out songs. If there's a demand for a full body of work, we'll see." So, you know, she was stress testing. Perhaps the label was fed up with investing a lot of money into an artist that did not provide a return. But being non-committal is kind of her whole problem. So this approach of droplets and having a song come out here and there was never going to work. That only works when you have relevance and you have momentum. And that's why surprise albums and surprise song releases are kind of a rarity in the industry. It takes a certain force and momentum to shift a mass market product on short notice. Katy also takes way too long to follow up Never Really Over. I actually really liked the follow-up though. 3-ish months later, Small Talk is released. And I think this is a very subtle, very funny, very Katy Perry song. It has an incredible pre-chorus. "I just can't believe how we went from strangers to lovers to strangers in a lifetime. Now there's nothing left but small talk." Again, that's a big feeling expressed in what I think is a pretty subtle and elegant way. I think it could have performed better if it chased Never Really Over more quickly and was part of an album campaign. The music video also follows along from that Never Really Over aesthetic, kind of this neo-70s, new-agey vibe. I cannot understand why, after Never Really Over, they didn't just start an album campaign, especially when they had songs locked and loaded. The song was also co-produced by Charlie Puth. I'll get back to that in a second. It takes another 2 months to follow up this song with Harley's in Hawaii. This is a fan favorite. I like it, but not as much as the first two. Nevertheless, it is good, and it has a really sexy, cool vibe, a nonchalance that is not very characteristic of Katy Perry, and this was also co-produced by Charlie Puth. That is a collaboration I really think that we moved on from too quickly. His ear for earnestness and melody, combined with her campy sensibilities, yielded really unique and interesting results. Also, I think it's important to note that all three of these songs that were pretty good did not rely on Dr. Luke or Max Martin to be good. This is a promising development. It shows that somewhere in Katy Perry there's an interest in being a songwriter, and there is some potential, again, when she's put in the right rooms with the right people. But it's never, ever consistent, and that is the entire problem. We're now in 2019, in October with Harley's in Hawaii, and Katy fully kills this droplet era with a dud like 4 or 5 months later, Never Worn White, a single with a music video announcing her pregnancy, days before the pandemic rocked the world. Personal announcements of this nature in song don't tend to be good, and this is no exception. It's boring, and it really just kind of reads of, how can we monetize the publicity stunt of me announcing my pregnancy? It bears no relationship to any of the songs that came before it. And then we get into Smile. Our queen of timing strikes again. She decides to launch a new era and a new album campaign in the pandemic while pregnant. Girl, this lead single is a bizarre song called Daisies, which is about revitalizing lost dreams, according to her. It is very generic and very bland. Here's some of the lyrics. Told me I was crazy, but I'll never let them change me until they cover me in daisies. The Guardian said, this song is basically Unconditionally and Tsunami and every other power ballad she's ever done. It's like a vague empowerment anthem about never changing even when you die. Not interesting. Not fun. Also, the promotional activities were strictly limited due to the pandemic, and what is everyone doing during the pandemic? They're bopping to future nostalgia. They're doing the savage dance on TikTok. No one is checking for Katy Perry's pregnant navel gazing. It's just not interesting. Luckily for Katy, it debuts at number 40 on the Hot 100, I think because it came with the momentum of announcing, guys, I have a new album coming out, but it doesn't go higher than that. The timing of this record is really cursed because she announces the title and releases the title track in the beginning of July 2020, mere weeks before Taylor Swift would surprise release Folklore and dominate the cultural conversation about music. Smile, the song, is yet another generic corny ballad. I'm so thankful, scratch that baby, I'm grateful, you'll see me shining for a mile. Now I got back that smile. It doesn't really help that the artistic direction for this record and song is clown. The jokes write themselves. Clown. What happened to that really cool, stylish 70s aesthetic we were playing with on Never Really Over and Small Talk? Why are we doing clowncore instead? It fails to chart, but of course. The record comes out in August to no great attention. It gets mixed reviews with everyone, again, kind of going, okay, another Katy Perry album. What's worse, everyone crowding around the car crash to look at how messed up the car is, witness, or everyone driving past the crash car on the side of the road because it doesn't look like the wreck was that bad and you don't really want to rescue the driver? Smile. You decide. Smile is Katy Perry's first album not to reach number one since her debut. In fact, it debuted at number 5. And the gag is, this record is probably a little bit better than Witness, partly because Never Really Over and Harley's in Hawaii are tacked on, but there are also some kind of fun moments here. Cry About It Later is an obvious single choice, but a pregnant lady could not really be out here doing dance floor music to promote the record during the pandemic, so why didn't we just wait? Beloved, why didn't we just wait? There's also Tucked and Champagne Problems, which are like mid but not terrible, and everything else on this record is either boring or bad. After this, it's back to Rent a Crowd and Legacy Act Behavior. She performs Firework at Joe Biden's inauguration. She releases a song no one ever listened to called Electric for Pokemon, and she also releases a surprisingly okay standalone single, When I'm Gone, that barely cracked the Hot 100. And she started a Vegas residency, which honestly was the perfect thing for her to do at this point. Let's move away from selling shoes and pop chips and making bad music and focus on when you were actually cool and good. The residency is called Play, and it looked amazing. I've watched it all on YouTube multiple times. Katy Perry was literally made for the Vegas Strip. It's right up her alley. She is such a great performer, and her shtick translates really well in a larger-than-life silly setting, and it goes on very successfully until November 2023. So in between Smile and 143, she's just kind of rocking. While doing her residency, she launches a non-alcoholic beverage. She stars in a Gap holiday ad. She's the face of Just Eats advertisements and remixes their jingle. But this is not the behavior of a legend or a diva. This is the behavior of an influencer. What is this? I think the Vegas residency really does help Katy make a recovery here somewhat by reminding the public of what we liked about her in the first place. However, she's also marred in controversy. Firstly, she's accused of sexual misconduct on the Teenage Dream music video set by her male model co-star. She has denied those allegations. I don't care to comment on the veracity of them. I'm just mentioning them to lay out here and explain why the public was kind of not feeling Katy at this specific period of time. It was like a combination of things that were either interpreted the wrong way or were stupid things that she actually did. She controversially endorsed the billion billionaire real estate investor Rick Caruso for mayor of LA instead of the progressive Democrat candidate Karen Bass. This is a big heel turn from the purposeful pop queen who stumped for Hillary. Rick Caruso was basically a Republican until a month before the race, apparently, and has a history of donating to anti-choice organizations and initiatives. Very antithetical to Katie's claimed beliefs in progressive values. She had to turn off her comments on socials when she announced this, which is really embarrassing for a star of your size. She also released a blackface shoe in her shoe line. Yes, a blackface shoe. And she has been locked in an expensive and unflattering legal battle with nuns over a convent property. I have not dug into the nuts and bolts of this case and don't have a dog in this fight, but one of the nuns collapsed and died during a post-judgment hearing, which again, doesn't really make Katie look good, whether she did anything wrong or not. And all of this took place before 143 was even a feather on the breath of God. So it wasn't like she was walking into friendly warm waters. So finally, here we are, 143, finally at present day. It's the summer of Chapel Roan, Charlie XCX, and Sabrina Carpenter. All these girlies are doing radically different things that feel very authentic to who they are as performers. Chapel Roan is a gay icon. Charlie is the party girl. Sabrina is our saucy, funny temptress. There's so much good music coming out this year. We've got all the big pop divas releasing, Ariana, Beyonce, Taylor, Dua. So of course, Katy Perry decides that after flopping 4 years ago, it's time to throw her hat in the ring again for one more cursed attempt. And how does she announce this glorious comeback with a stacked competition? Oh, by releasing a 15-second clip of a song called Woman's World, an apparent feminist battle cry produced by Dr. Luke. I can't describe to you how despicable, ironic, and humiliating this is. First of all, Dr. Luke is a noted pariah. I believe Kesha. I believe all the other female artists who have spoken about their experiences with him, that he is not a good person and we should not be supporting his work or creating conditions where he can continue to work with young, vulnerable female artists. Here's what I really think happened between Katie and Dr. Luke. She never wanted to stop working with him. She only did so because he became persona non grata in the Me Too movement and it was inopportune for them to collab. I think also in her mind, she thought, I started to flop when I got rid of Dr. Luke. Maybe there's a correlation between that. In her mind somewhere, I think she imagined that enough time had passed and other artists were working with him, like Impetrus, so it would be totally fine for her to return to his studio. And besides, wasn't everybody always asking where 2011 Katy Perry had gone? Maybe she could resurrect her. No. Wrong. Choosing to work with Dr. Luke is an extremely distasteful thing to do, especially when you are a female artist espousing the power that women have in this world. By all accounts, Dr. Luke is an agent of terror amongst women in the music industry, and Katie has never experienced this because she's always had the upper hand as a star who can choose to work with him. Smaller artists often have no choice but to do so. There is a lot of nonsense of Katy Perry defenders saying she's locked into a contract with him. She's not. She's choosing to do this. To add insult to injury, Kesha and Katie were actually friends. She was in the I Kissed a Girl music video. If Katy Perry has some sort of personal relationship with Dr. Luke and has never experienced this horrific side of him, fine. But she and her fans cannot act outraged or surprised that people do not like it when you choose to work with him. If you didn't do your sentiment analysis of how this would go down, Doja Cat and Kim Petras get heat every day on social media. I do not feel sorry for the lashings that you're getting on social media. You brought it on yourself. And you know what? Karma came to get her ass because Woman's World is a humiliating, hollow, sinister attempt at recapturing the optimism and hope of 2010. It flopped. And not even because Dr. Luke worked on it, because it was a bad song created with the intention to recover a career on life support. Humiliating. The decision to work with Dr. Luke single-handedly ended this era before it even started. Woman's World has been ripped apart, including by me, at length, so I won't go too much further into it, but in an interview on Call Her Daddy, Katie failed to come up with an adequate response to why she chose to work with Dr. Luke and what she thinks of the backlash. She's in full reality denial. In all of the interviews that I've seen that she's been giving about this record, the backlash is completely ignored. Everyone's just acting as though, you know, she's doing a normal album cycle and everybody's loving it. The commercial floppage, you know, not discussed. And she is also barely eloquent about what this album even means. You can see in her eyes that she is not interested in talking about it. The title for this record also is The Digital Language for Love. Well, isn't that the most original album concept you've ever heard? It also takes Katie a while to respond when asked for specifics about how she feels about these songs or how they were created in interviews. She describes the song Gorgeous with Kim Petras as a song that she imagines will play in the back of a lot of makeup tutorials. If you're going into the studio trying to make songs to play in people's makeup tutorials, I don't want to listen to that. Then Lifetimes comes out and it's another generic flop, also marred in controversy. Apparently her team did not seek the appropriate environmental license to shoot wherever they were, potentially damaging the climate. Congratulations, Queen. Woman's World peaked at number 63. Lifetimes didn't chart. And I'm Hissy's Mine was her first single ever to have the honor of not even charting in a single country. The album is dead, and Katy Perry's career as a pop star is dead because this is a culmination of all the things she has neglected throughout her career. Artistic evolution and integrity. Standing beside the work that you create and being proud of it. Selecting collaborators that reflect values people want to see in the world. world and making songs that people want to hear, not songs that are designed to chart well, recapture your former glory, and make money. If I'm sounding a little bit harsh at this point, it's because I'm frustrated that an artist that I do see potential in is steadfastly refusing to change and instead just kind of operating from the same playbook over and over again. And you know what? I've jabbered on. My voice actually hurts from talking too much, so I'm gonna stop here. That is my treatise on how Katy Perry murdered her career. It would mean a lot to me if you left a comment down below and respectfully let me know how you feel about the situation, and I will see you in my next video. Goodbye.